This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. And this week, we are here to talk about the Florida Springs Heritage Area. And with us is Haley Moody, who is the director of the Florida Springs Institute. But before we get to that, we have to do the chit-chat small talk where I ask Rick how he's doing. How you doing, Rick?
This is my second Zoom today, so a little bit different. But we're back in our regular morning time, which feels more comfortable.
It does.
You're coming to Central Florida tomorrow, right?
I'm coming to Central Florida. I'm very excited. I'm probably even going to do a post about the place we're staying because it looks incredible. I love finding these little off the beaten path. I found this Verbo that's in somebody's backyard that also has a Swedish massage or Swedish sauna. So,
all right, we're going to have to talk. This is interesting to me because I've been trying to picture where you are and I can't figure it out. And you said it's okay. We'll talk.
Yes.
So there are hidden places you can stay in Orlando that aren't giant motels.
I am, you know, sometimes a giant motel is nice because sometimes what you want to do is be able to have food sent up to your room, have somebody come make your bed and have a cocktail at 10 o'clock at night without going out to a bar. But by and large, I like to find these pockets of Florida and increasingly we used to think it would be a city. Or a town or a community, but increasingly, and I kind of like this, you have these people kind of guarding these pockets of Florida in their own backyard. And I think that's really kind of cool. It's sad that we can't just say, oh, the whole town of Orlando is amazingly unrefined and there's no traffic, and which no one has ever said about Orlando. And it's just all these little mom and pop businesses. But the reality is, amidst the Rodizio Grill and the Universal Studios Islands of Vomit or whatever, they're clearly not going to sponsor us ever. I'm not a roller coaster
Not now.
Fan. Not now. No, I don't think they were knocking anyway. In between all these mega dinner and show things that you find, you can still find these pockets of Florida where these guys, I mean, the Verbo is incredible. Like, it has all 10 out of 10 reviews, and the pictures just show this wild backyard that is, I believe, on a lake and just very peaceful and a lot of trees and shrubbery and not very manicured. Like, it just looks like a backyard in Florida should have looked. But, and it makes me happy.
Yay!
So, yes. And Orlando, I forget until I start looking at aerial views of Orlando, how many damn lakes there are. And that makes me think, what's the difference between a lake and a spring?
Well, we have a guest here who can answer that question.
Oh, my goodness. That's right. We do. Did you like that segue?
Yeah, awesome.
So welcome, Haley.
Oh, thank you so much.
You didn't know you were going to start with a quiz, did you?
I didn't. I hope it doesn't get any harder than this.
We make no promises.
Okay, the difference between a lake and a spring. There are spring-fed lakes. There absolutely are. So let's see. The difference between a lake and a spring. Lakes are typically filled with surface water and not groundwater. So springs are discharging groundwater from the Floridan aquifer. Which is our lime rock aquifer underground. Springs are discharging that water because that water is under pressure. So it's like trying to pour water into a cup that's already full. It's going to find its way out. And that's what springs are. So if there isn't that pressure, bless you.
I've managed to mute myself so no one can hear me sneeze.
Nice work.
So, yes. Okay.
Oh,
so
I have a question. So this is
already
our guest is Haley Moody from the Florida Springs Institute.
I said
the director. You said Haley. Okay. Maybe you did. Anyways. So is it possible that there are surficial aquifers above the Floridan aquifer, and could those surficial aquifers feed lakes? because in Orlando, which we've already discussed is the land of a million lakes, there are a lot of lakes. There are a lot of lakes that people say are spring fed, and including my own. And what I know is during the summer, when we have, you know, a lot of rain happening every day, there are areas where there are bubbles coming up constantly. And my theory is they're like, what do you call them? Water tables, springs, or when the water level gets high enough in the superficial aquifer, it has to escape because of pressure. Could that be true?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yay. My theory has been proven by an authority on springs. Okay. Now back to the show.
Well, that was actually what I was going to ask. Believe it or not, that was what I was starting to say, is it possible that there can be something similar to what you said? I wasn't going to say it as eloquently.
Well, the other thing is, what is it? Water weighs what, like eight pounds a gallon or something like that. There's so much water on top in a lake on top of the spring, it's unlikely you'll see a boil. Is that correct? It's usually just because, you know, there's a lake where Orlando was formed. There was originally a fort in the Seminole Wars between three lakes, and everybody insists that this lake is spring fed, and they only can, when they do alum treatments to get rid of all the gunky stuff in the lake, they can see, you know, a little cliff kind of thing when the water clarity is greater, and they insist that's a spring. And, you know, what I always figured is, you know, there's not enough when with all that water weight on top of it, you can't see a boil on the surface.
Yeah. So that would be similar to, you know, when we have brownouts at springs,
right?
When surface water rises over the spring water, and the pressure from the spring water discharging isn't enough to push that surface water back. So what you see is brown.
Right.
This can happen a lot at springs like Troy.
Yeah.
You'll show up and you'll just see the brown surface water. But if you can get in there and dive down deep enough, it'll become clear. So yeah, a similar thing. You know, the Floridan aquifer is really complex. There's so much going on underground, that, you know, there are these pockets, there is a superficial aquifer. There are these pockets of, confining layers that complicate things, make things, different. So it is a very complex system. And there are these things happening all the time, like you're saying, spring fed lakes that, you know, when that potentiometric surface is what it's called, when that groundwater surface is high enough, you know, that groundwater will come out of sinkholes or cracks in the lime rock. But when that potentiometric surface drops, they just become sinkholes again.
Oh.
So this is something that happens. And I think, you know, a good example of maybe people know about White Sulphur Springs, the town of White Springs. It's on the Suwannee River. And, you know, this spring was at the turn of the century. It was known as Florida's first tourist destination. People were coming from all over, flocking to this place to... and maybe a lot of places are known as Florida's first tourist destination.
They are. I call BS on that. The town likes to put that out there, but I would argue Silver Springs has them beat.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Sorry. They built an amazing spring house around this spring, and people would jump off of the third story into the spring water. But today it's essentially a sinkhole, and there's a flow reversal happening where it's actually sucking water from the Suwannee down into the Floridan aquifer. So it's no longer discharging that fresh water.
How is that possible? Can you explain a flow reversal? I had not
heard that. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Sure. Okay. So, like I was saying, a spring is an opening in the lime rock where that groundwater, when it's under pressure, discharges out of that opening. But if there is a change in the amount of groundwater, if the amount of groundwater is reduced, and that could be to drought, and that could also be due to groundwater pumping. and it could be a combination of both. But when that potentiometric surface of the aquifer drops, that water is no longer under pressure. It's no longer going to discharge out of that opening. And in these springs that are close to their river that they're discharging into, like the Suwannee River, that surface water will start to come into and cover the lime rock opening. And it'll start to suck that surface water down into the aquifer. So that's what's called a flow reversal.
And so I know, so for some contextual material, you know, the big concrete enclosure, a lot of people think it's like limestone or coquina. It's just concrete, I think, with a different aggregate. But there's a gate between where the spring used to be and the Suwannee, and they used to have this wooden thing that would go up and lower it and keep the brown tannin stained water out back when it was a spa. But the gate's been gone for years, so that there's nothing stopping, you know, the two waters from mixing. But I have heard when there's big water events, like big rains, like from a tropical storm, that it'll flow again and you could smell the sulfur. Have you experienced that?
I haven't myself, no.
I haven't, and it seems crazy. But, Todd Kincaid, who's a hydrogeologist, I think, said that the springs are ephemeral systems, that, you know, they can come back to life if there are big rain events, even if they haven't had flow, you know. And I've seen Kissingen Springs in Polk County, which is a famous spring that has dried up. After a large rain event, there's puddles, you know, like it there's water flow again. Springs are fascinating, which I think brings us to the topic we wanted to discuss today, not spring-fed lakes, which is the creation of a national heritage area for Florida springs, which is, this is different from what was proposed with a national park, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
And so how did what's the genesis of this idea?
Sure. Before I get into that, I would just like to say thank you for saying that. Springs that have gone dry absolutely can come back to life. That is very true. So thank you for that. So a Florida Springs National Heritage Area. This is different than a national park. And how we got involved with this idea originally was exploring the idea of a national park for the springs. Back in 2021, we got a small grant from the National Park Conservation Association, which is an amazing organization. They act like the friends of group of the national parks, and they're incredible. But we got a small grant for them and started exploring this idea, what it would look like to have a national park for the springs. I think anybody that spent time in some of our incredible state parks and some of our springs know just how world-class these places are. I mean, they really are. They're breathtaking. We were pursuing the idea because traditionally national parks have had land protections that come along with them. That's really what's required in order to protect our springs. Some people may not realize this, but springs don't just exist in the location that they are. So, a lot of people are familiar with the idea of a river basin, sort of the large area around a river that contributes water to that river. So springs have the same thing. They have what's called a spring shed. So a spring shed is the area around a spring that contributes groundwater to that spring. And these areas are very large. So for example, Silver Springs spring shed it's over 1,000 square miles. And we have 33 first magnitude springs across the state. So you can imagine, and then a whole bunch more other springs. So you can imagine all of these spring sheds are sort of just overlapping all the way across our state. So in order to protect the spring and the water that's coming out of the spring and the health of the spring, you really have to protect that land and what's happening on the land surface.
Did you start having meetings with people about this idea and going around and kind of floating you know, what would it look like to have a national park?
That's right. So we started having stakeholder meetings to sort of test this theory and invited a lot of our sister organizations and conservation groups. And we sort of expected that people would be really excited and think it was a great idea. And we were kind of preaching to the choir, everybody would get on board. And that is not what happened.
Really?
We had a pretty strong response that this was going to be incredibly difficult in Florida. And this was coming from people who had attempted certain conservation measures in the past and ended up having to have armed guards at their meetings because people were getting so nervous about the idea of federal land acquisition in Florida, about the, you know, the government coming to take their land.
That is so not what I'm scared of the government doing.
Protecting our land. You know, the land rights people are very strong. You know, there are a couple of things that I really disagree with my late father on. And he was a big land rights guy. And he thought, you know, it's you buy the land, it's yours. You can do with whatever. And the government had no right to take it from you. And he, you know, he died believing that wholeheartedly. And a lot of people believe that, you know, even if it's for the better good, he was against it. And I think a lot of people think that way.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I'm not trying to change, you know, how people think. I think I really just, you know, we took in this information and it became clear that, it, you know, maybe we needed to shift strategies. And so, it also became clear that the education piece was such a big part of this, that it's really hard to, you know, it's hard to convince someone of anything, really.
In this day and age, it's so difficult.
You know, people have to feel it for themselves. They have to experience it for themselves, and they really have to make that decision for themselves. And so we decided to shift strategies and move toward a national heritage area instead. This was something that was suggested to us, and it is a designation that is within the National Park Service, under the Department of the Interior. But it's more of a grassroots, it's more of a ground up approach than a top down approach. And we really felt like that was the way to move forward for these special places, is to get everyone involved in how they're managed. And so that's what we're pursuing.
So what would that look like? Would the, you know, like, so in a national park, you know, take, for example, Yosemite, you know, you drive and you climb up the mountains and then there's a big sign. And eventually at some point you have to pay admission to go in there, and everything around you is national park. And there's a couple commercial entities within the park, but you're basically in wilderness. So how is that different for a national heritage area?
Sure. So again, like I was saying, the point of this is education. You know, we're trying to get, we have 1,000 people a day moving to the state. We have 1 million people coming to visit us every year. And the idea is that everyone that comes here will be hit with this education of the Floridan Aquifer and the Florida Springs. So the National Heritage Area, the proposed boundary, is the entire Florida Springs region. So that's the entire northern 2/3 of the state.
What's the southern boundary then of that?
Yeah. So it's everywhere north of Lake Okeechobee.
Oh, wow.
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 Mm-hmm. Are there springs by like State Road 70? Are there springs of consequence?
Are there springs of consequence? So this is the challenging piece in thinking about, where a national heritage area would be, because it's hard to exclude any springs from that, right? Because the person living next door to a third magnitude spring that they've gone to ever since they were a child, that is the most important spring. So we chose the freshwater extent of the Floridan aquifer. So this is everywhere in Florida that a spring exists, any spring, any freshwater spring, northern two-thirds of the state. And I know that seems like an enormous boundary, and it is. But National Heritage Areas are lived-in landscapes. And so, for example, the entire state of Tennessee is in a National Heritage Area.
Really? Did not know that.
And what does it mean specifically? I mean, how does it change things for the property owners there? They can still live there, right?
Yes, they can still live there. So the idea behind a National Heritage Area is that it is the people living within the National Heritage Area and also the organizations that are making the decisions about the land management. So there is a local coordinating entity that would be coordinating all of this. And in our proposal, we have separated the Florida Springs region into four sub-regions. And so there would be a sort of educational hub or a center for the National Heritage Area within each of these four sub-regions. And then there would be a local coordinating entity coordinating all of those. So the sub-regions are based on the major river systems. It would be the Suwannee sub-region, the St. John's sub-region, the Panhandle sub-region, and then a Gulf Coast sub-region. And the reason to break these into sub-regions is because springs management is regional. So there are, you know, certain springs that are clustered together that are going to be much more similar and face similar challenges in certain areas than there are in others. So, for example, the springs in the Ocala National Forest are going to need, you know, different management strategies than maybe the Gulf Coast springs. You know, those are, you know, they're facing some saltwater intrusion. There's just some different challenges there.
Yes. And speaking of that, would this include some of the springs that we have in the Gulf or in the Atlantic?
Actually in the water?
Yeah.
So this is really a land management strategy, at least our proposal as it exists now. So these are just the ones that are land-based.
Okay.
So isn't, okay, I was going to go on. No, sidetracks.
We gotta stay on the road.
I know. Because I, you know, the whole idea of springs flowing up in the middle of water is where we started. And I'm fascinated by that. And I think other people are interested too. But so like, how do you, it seems like a heavy lift because, you know, what I've witnessed in this state and, you know, the last 30 years is the restrictions on what you could do to land have been lessened over time in the recent history of the state, in my opinion. How do you increase people's education to show that more limitations, maybe that's not the best stewardship, maybe a better word, is a good idea? Because that seems like the hard thing to overcome because of this whole land rights thing that it's just kind of hard for people to... you know, a great example is like, you know, I live on a small lake and everybody wants to put whatever they want on their yard to keep their St. Augustine looking grass looking great. So they'll spray these things that are detrimental to the health of the lake. And they feel that that's their right. Is it just education? How do you overcome that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is education. I think it's also organization and it's also collaboration. So there are some things that you can accomplish through education and there are some things that you can't, I would say. So, you know, I think, you know, depending on what is determined by each of the stakeholders within each of the subregions, you know, something that we would propose looking into, something that has been successful, are carrying capacities for springs. But science-based carrying capacities, not carrying capacities based on the parking lot size, for example. So that's something that we would encourage and support, would be a scientific study on carrying capacities for some of these springs to place limits on the amount of people that can realistically experience the spring without harming it. I think it would be, it's going to be a multi-pronged approach. It's going to be a big effort, and it is a big lift, but at the same time, that's why a National Heritage Area feels like the appropriate designation, because there are so many stakeholders, individuals, organizations that are so dedicated to these places. And it's really just a matter of getting organized and getting everyone together. Something that was really interesting just in the stakeholder calls that we had, just in, you know, these little 15-minute conversations we had with people from all over the state on the call. Somebody who had achieved a springs protection zone in one area of the state was giving advice to somebody who was looking to achieve a springs protection zone in another area of the state. And they just hadn't connected yet. So being able to get people together and have these conversations, I think, is really where the power is and where we can make the most change.
Well, so exactly what does a springs protection zone mean? Sorry, that's a tough one, but I mean, I've visualized people not being able to fertilize their yard and stuff like that. Is that what it means?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't think I'm going to have the exact language to give you. The ones that were being discussed and the reasons that they were being discussed were due to over recreation in the spring runs.
I see.
Over recreation.
I think some attempts to place some limits around that.
So where they do that, like at Itchituckney is the first one that comes to mind. Is that proven to be successful, the way they limit the number of people who go down the spring run there? I mean, is it helping the health of the spring? Is it been proven successful?
Proven successful. I think that's a great question. And I'd have to see if there have been any studies to follow up on that original Charles Dutoit study from 1979 to see if I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. I would say that the spring is in pretty good shape.
I think, honestly, apocryphal stories are as good as anything. I mean, you know, we did this whole thing with John Moran's photos that are basically just visual evidence. And I think you can tell, you know, just if the submerged vegetation comes back, that, you know, that alone, I think, is an indication that it's successful.
Something that I suppose I can speak to is that there is a portion of the lower Itchituckney River that is not within Itchituckney Springs State Park. Uh-huh. And so that portion doesn't have any recreation limits. And the eelgrass and the submerged aquatic vegetation is all but completely stripped away in that area. So the nice lush grasses and aquatic vegetation that you see within the state park, once you get past that boundary, it's gone. It's gone.
Honestly, I think that's evidence enough that it's successful, because that's why they put that in place. It's my understanding the whole ecosystem is based on underwater vegetation flourishing, and without that, everything starts to kind of fall apart. I was shocked when I went to Salt, and you know, I have these memories of Salt Springs as a teenager, where I was grossed out by all the eelgrass because you would just have to wade through it, and I was a little kid, you know, and it was like hit me in the face, yeah. You know, and then went there as an adult, there wasn't any, You know, there was none, completely devoid of any underwater vegetation at all. And, you know, so it was, you know, there were a few blue crabs, but otherwise lifeless. And I, you know, I have these incredible memories of going in there at nighttime and just being surrounded by mullet everywhere. And it was mesmerizing, you know, and beautiful. But as a, my last trip there,
probably
they were gone.
Traumatic for the mullet.
I'm sure they still talk about me, I think, with their little mullet tongues and mullet mouth. Sorry, I didn't mean for that to be hard, because I just, I think that's such a great idea. And, you know, disclaimer, I've been trying to help write some of the human history of the springs, because I think that's an important part of the story that is often overlooked. And, you know, humans, as long as there's been humans in Florida, we know that there's been, they've interacted with each other, you know, and so that alone is a reason to protect them, because there's archaeological evidence of human existence at all the springs, you know, and they should be preserved, and we should be better caretakers of them.
So what can people do? What can our listeners do if they, if they're listening to you, Haley, and they're listening and they want to have that experience where they too can one day be in a spring and traumatize mullet, and they want to see springs protected and all those things. What can we tell our listeners? You go to the show notes, click on what should they be doing?
Sure. So the number one thing you can do if you're interested in any of this is to inform yourself. So reach out to us at the Florida Springs Institute. We have a lecture series called the Springs Academy Lecture Series. It's once a month up in our building in High Springs. And we touch on all the major springs topics. We also put those on Facebook Live. So you can, if you can't come up to High Springs, you can watch them remotely. And just start to learn about these springs, about these incredible places. If you want to become a stakeholder in the Florida Springs National Heritage Area, reach out to me. And we will get you into those meetings and on those calls and start discussing what we can do next to protect our springs.
And what is that email address? How can they reach out to you?
You can reach out to me at hmoody, M-O-O-D-Y. At floridaspringsinstitute.org. And that's all spelled out.
And that is, of course, going in our show notes as we speak.
Okay, great.
Real time. So do you recommend people kind of stop in and see you in High Springs? I know you have the Welcome Center up there. And, you know, if you're going to Jenny or Gilchrist Blue, High Springs is on the way if you're coming from Gainesville, and worth a stop, in my estimation. But so can you tell us about the Welcome Center and the great exhibit in the back?
Yes, we have beautiful exhibits. We have a beautiful sign designed by Rick Kildee.
What? Right. Rick Kildee? You had something to do with that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Shocking.
And my Fountain of Youth exhibit's in there too.
Sorry,
so
go ahead.
We're on Main Street in High Springs. And that's right. We're on the way to Jenny, Itchituckney, Poe, Gilchrist Blue. So come see us up there. We're open from 10 to the public from 10 to 4 during the week, Monday through Friday. And we have museum exhibits. We have a fully articulated manatee skeleton on loan from FWC. We have a mastodon, a full-size mastodon jaw replica. Of something that was pulled out of a river in Citrus County. We have all kinds of incredible exhibits. You can learn about the history of Florida Springs from this incredible set of signage from Rick. And we have a spring store, so you can come up there and shop. We have Springs artists like Leslie Peebles and Jane Medved that just have incredible work in there. So yeah, come see us, please. And this is where our lectures take place as well. So we have an event space, and yeah.
High Springs is a good destination. You know, there's a great restaurant there, and there's a brewery there too, right?
There's a brewery there. We have actually,
I believe that is now the law in Florida. When there is a spring, there has to be a brewery.
Yep. There's a brewery. We've got a couple of good pizza places. The Great Outdoors, of course. Spins is an incredible sandwich shop. They just expanded, so I have to talk about them a little bit. And there's a lot of changes happening in High Springs. A lot of little stores and shops going in. We're going to have a sweet shop, Serendipity Sweets, opening pretty soon. So yeah, it's a place that is changing, and I'm very excited about the changes. So.
And I want to point out, too, if we're talking about this and we're talking about the aquifer and you're not a person who can hear things and visualize, the Florida Springs Institute, we're going to put a link in the show notes, has a wonderful pocket guide that will break it down a little bit more. And that pocket guide doesn't just have sciencey things in it, but it does talk about the different water management districts, how the springs work, and then it also helps you understand some of the acronyms that they might talk about. But this is kind of a what you need to know to understand all the stuff Kathy and Rick talk about when they talk about springs, like the aquifer and all that. It is not a guide to finding the springs. It is a guide to understanding them, which we have plenty of literature about how to find springs in Florida. But I love the pocket guide here because it really does break down how springs work.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy, for mentioning that. That's awesome. Yeah. Angeline Meeks and I put together that pocket guide. It was part of our Blue Water Audit project that was Angeline's brainchild. She's such an incredible person. So thank you for mentioning that. Yeah.
Well, it's important because I think sometimes we could do a better job of explaining some of the things. Like I think we all get so excited and we talk about these things. And sometimes when people like me, people like I or Rick or the three of us get together and we're like, the aquifer, the limestone. And there's probably people listening to this going, that shit is a limestone tunnel. What does that mean? And so this does a really good job of breaking it down. I would definitely give a shout out to one of our paid listeners, Bets Boys Adventures, and say that it is not oversimplified, but those kids who do their YouTube videos as they travel could probably download this pocket guide and understand it easily. And that's kind of my measure of what's going to make it easy, because American humans will only consume so much education before they need to watch a rerun of Psych or something. So,
and honestly, some of the MFLs and CFLs and all ICBMs and all this kind of crazy stuff is so...
Isn't that Intercontinental Ballistic
Missile? I think
missile?
So, but there's okay. All these acronyms with springs that I just get lost in. And so any help is great. And, you know, it's mind blowing to think when you think that, you know, there's these tunnels and cavities, these huge cavities under our feet, you know, for most of the state, you know, and there is the Biscayne Aquifer in South Florida, which is a completely different aquifer. But this enormous thing stretches all over the Southeast and has who knows how much water. And some of the water is very old. Some of the water is not as old because, like you said, it reverses flow and goes down into the aquifer. But it's a fascinating, complex system. I love, you know, when you see those photographs that people who are cave divers take in those caverns, because some of them are enormous and spectacular. And they have things like you talked about, the big mammoth or mastodon bone. Somebody needs to tell me what the difference is, because I'm getting them all mixed up all the time.
It's a totally different podcast. We'll have a mammoth and mastodon expert on in a future podcast.
Thank
We're
you.
Really stretching Haley here. Like, I'm going to give her an easy question.
Okay, sorry. Sorry.
Haley, if a mastodon leaves Itchitechny traveling at... No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. What is your favorite spring? Can you pick one?
Oh, gosh. This is tough.
Yeah, for a springs person, it's
like
putting them on the spot.
Asking you to pick your favorite cheese. I get it.
Favorite cheese. That's right. You know, I'm going to stick with Itchitechny. I think Itchitechny Spring Group. I'm not going to pick one, but I will say the Itchitechny Spring Group. That would be my favorite. I think that's the spring I went to when I just fell in love and knew that this was what I was going to be doing in my career, is working for these springs. So I'd say it's Chautauqua.
Good answer.
Good answer. Good answer. We'll allow it.
So you're not on a spring now. Is that Payne's Prairie behind you? It looks spectacular, but through your back window.
This is actually, here, I'll turn this around. This is Tuscarawas Lake.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So that's not a Zoom background.
No, that's a real piece of old Florida.
I'm looking at it going, that is a beautiful Zoom background. So
I'm in Micanopy right now, and this is Tuscarawas Prairie, Tuscarawas Lake. Sometimes it's dry, sometimes it's not. I can see a bald eagle flying over. So that's, I watch, awesome. This lake actually does drain down into the aquifer very slowly. We've got a nice confining layer here, so there is clay through the soil, but I get a good view of what's going on in the aquifer by looking out here and seeing what's going on in the prairie.
Pretty awesome. Neat.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast today. We really, really enjoyed having you. And we will, of course, have in the show notes a whole bunch of different ways people can interact. Before we go, we want to thank our active supporters. These are the people who pay us at least $3 a month, sometimes as much as $10 a month, woo-hoo! Just so Rick and I can come on here and chat. And they get cool stuff. Bill Grable, Stephanie Hewley, Brad Sager, Brian Woodall, Bet's Boys Adventure, I already mentioned them, Elise Smith, Carol Miller, Leslie Hallweg, Davida Breyer, Natalie Zacharick, Angela Connolly, John Bound, Ryan Worthington, and of course, Sulcata Grove. Thank you all for supporting us. And please, please, please consider hopping over to floridaspectacular.buzzsprout.com and click on the support button and find all the ways to support us and see what kind of cool stuff we will send you. Anything to add, Rick?
My brain just went off spiraling thinking that Sulcata Grove sounds like a place to use in a work of fiction about Florida.
And there's lots of tortoises, right?
Yeah, maybe a dead body somewhere.
So we're losing their support now. We're going to...
Well, you know...
We know you didn't really kill people.
No, they didn't have anything to do with it. But I'm just thinking, you know, that as a place, that would be great. It'd be cool. Sorry, that's the way my mind works.
You've had a lot of coffee this morning, haven't you?
I'm drinking kombucha right now. So that's my brain on kombucha.
The sugar will get you. All right. Well, that'll do it for us this time. We will see you next time on Florida Spectacular.